Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Listen to your favorite podcasts on any device with Pocket Casts. You can start an episode on your phone during your commute, pick up where you left off on your laptop at work, then finish at home on a smart speaker like Alexa without missing a beat. Download the free Pocket Casts app today for Android or iOS. Find us online at pocketcast.com or use the app on Alexa, Chromecast, Sonos, Apple Watch, and CarPlay.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Friday, the 28th of February, these are our main stories. The World Health Organization says the fight against the coronavirus has reached a decisive point, with more than 40 countries now struggling to contain the infection. There are reports that many Turkish troops have been killed in an airstrike in Idlib province in northern Syria. Malawi becomes the latest country in southern Africa to legalize the production and export of cannabis. Also in this podcast, Placido Domingo rose back on his apology for inappropriate sexual behaviour, and
I am Detective Lieutenant Elliot, and this is Trooper Wagner.
We just want to ask a few questions.
Why you'll never see a baddie with an iPhone. The World Health Organization has repeated its warning that the coronavirus has the potential to become a pandemic and said every country needs to take action. Globally, there are now over 80,000 cases in more than 40 countries. The head of the WHO is Tedros Ghebreyesus.
We're at a decisive point. For the past 2 days, the number of new cases reported in the rest of the world has exceeded the number of new cases reported from China. And in the past 24 hours, 7 countries have reported cases for the first time. My message to each of these countries is, this is your window of opportunity. If you act aggressively now, you can contain this virus. You can prevent people getting sick. You can save lives.
Many governments have announced new measures to try to contain the virus. Japan has ordered the closure of all schools for a month. Iran has banned visitors from China and cancelled Friday prayers in Tehran. Saudi Arabia is preventing foreign pilgrims from visiting religious sites like Mecca. We've heard from two people who had been planning to make the pilgrimage there.
My name is Saud Ali and I'm from Mumbai, India. I got a call today morning from my travel agent and he told me that due to the coronavirus outbreak, Saudi Arabia has suspended all the Umrah pilgrimage visits and other visas as well. So there won't be any flights going there. So we had to cancel our plans. Literally, I feel very bad about it because I've been making plans to go for this pilgrimage for months now. In seconds, all of this went in vain. Actually, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, the pilgrimage. I wish I go there very soon. I wish all of these things get sorted out quickly.
My name is Muneeb and I'm working in Dubai. I'm here in Pakistan to visit my family and we had a plan to go to Saudi for this Umrah. Me and my wife, my little daughter and my mother was among me and we were happy because for us, for Muslims, it's a quite, you know, satisfactory thing that you're going to such holy place. And we are currently thinking like maybe it is a good fortune for us. If we go there, we might be subjected to all these risks. But obviously we are sad too because it's a big thing for us.
Meanwhile, in China's Hubei province, where the outbreak began, medical staff are overwhelmed. Our China correspondent John Sudworth has been speaking to one doctor working on the front line in the city of Wuhan.
In a Wuhan hospital, a doctor is fighting to save the life of a patient. Attached to an artificial respirator, the man in the bed is pale, sweating, and he looks scared. In another scene, the same doctor is poring over figures with colleagues. All of them are wearing full protective suits, masks and goggles. These video clips, captured on colleagues' mobile phones, show the front line of the massive battle to save the city of Wuhan. The BBC has been given rare, officially approved access to Dr. Xie Jiang, a lung specialist who we were able to interview over the phone.
Okay, I came to Wuhan 1 month ago. That's the most difficult time for the country. Patients were pouring into the hospital like a tide. We do not have enough beds. That's a big challenge for us. And I think things are holding up better right now because we discharge a lot of patients and we have beds waiting for the patients. Everything is getting better, I think.
Wuhan shows what the virus can do to a health system. The thousands of extra beds in rapidly built hospitals, even some in sports stadiums, have begun to make a difference. But there are still major challenges.
I'm not satisfactory with the mortality. I still think the mortality is really too high. Just like for patients with severe symptoms, the mortality is even higher than SARS. That's the thing we should address right now.
Could the government get more equipment to you? Or is the situation just so overwhelming that it's simply impossible to get the sort of resources you need to treat everybody?
You know, we were running off those cutting edge reparators before, you know, and the condition, the resources are much better right now. But it's not only the resources, you know, you need a team, you need medical staff who can operate those cutting edge reparators. We did press the authorities to provide more cutting edge reparators like ECMO or mechanical ventilations, and I should say that they did try their best to provide as many as they can.
In the serious cases, the virus attacks the lungs, and the videos provided to the BBC show Dr. Xie trying to keep some of these patients alive. No city in the world, he says, would have enough of the specialist respirators required. Even doctors have died, including Li Wenliang, one of the first to try to warn about the dangers of the virus, only to be silenced by the police.
He warned the public that something like SARS was coming, and he was interrogated by the police, and it turned out to be the truth. I was very sad when I heard this kind of news. It's really a big blow for the whole medical stuff.
Do you think that there are lessons for China to learn as a result of Li Wenliang's death?
First of all, is that information disclosure is really important for China and for the rest of the world to avoid any disaster like this. Like, always take quick action, just like we locked down Wuhan. Kind of timely, right? And if we did it earlier, maybe the result can be better.
You're there on the front line. There is a concern that in parts of the rest of the world, there is a sense of complacency about this virus. From what you've seen, what message would you like to send to the international community?
Oh, it's really serious, you know. I lost 5 patients in one night. Can you imagine that? In one night, I lost 5 lives. That's really miserable. And I should warn the rest of the world that you guys should take care. Don't neglect this disease.
Dr. Xie Jiang with my colleague John Sudworth. The battle for Syria's Idlib province rages on as government troops backed by Russia continue their offensive against rebel forces supported by Turkey. As we record this podcast, there are unconfirmed reports that a large number of Turkish soldiers have been killed or wounded by an airstrike. I've been finding out the latest from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
The one official confirmation we have so far from the Turkish side, the governor of Hatay province, which is where the Turkish troops casualties have been taken, says that 22 soldiers have died. Now, other reports from Syrian activists say at least 34 people have been killed, and there's other figures which are swirling around, different stories about what may have happened, whether it was one particular airstrike that hit a particular target and was responsible, or it's several attacks during the day. What is clear, though, is this is the biggest loss of life so far of the Turkish involvement in this part of Syria, Idlib, the last bastion held by rebel fighters, where there's 3 million people holed up, many of them having escaped from other areas. We've seen in the past weeks this mass exodus, at least 1 million people fleeing from the fighting. In the last few days, we've seen a counteroffensive by the rebel fighters against government forces. They've retaken two strategic towns, two key towns that they'd lost only recently. And that is very much to do with Turkey having increased its direct military support. It's brought in thousands more troops. It's brought in many, many more military vehicles. It's really putting its weight behind the rebel fighters in the same way that Russia has for years done so with the Syrian forces. So, of course, this raises the specter of a major confrontation between those two countries.
And we know the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is having a meeting right now. Assuming what we think has happened, what will the consequences be?
That meeting, we believe, is finished. It was held for a couple of hours, an emergency meeting, as these reports were swirling around. One thing we've heard from this so far, it's not from a confirmed source as yet, but from Turkish intelligence sources, is that the Turks are likely to say that they are going to let the new lot of Syrian refugees go towards Europe if necessary. Now, they've been bottled up because Turkey had closed the border. Turkey already has more than 3.5 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. It's threatened before, for various reasons, to unleash those refugees towards Europe again. And this seems a new threat that we're going to hear from the Turks over this situation to try and get focus from the international community, from the US, from Western powers, etc., to do something with what's going on in Idlib and not leave it just to Turkey.
Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher with me. Malawi has become the latest Southern African country to legalise the growing, selling and exporting of cannabis. The plant's been grown illegally for decades and smuggled out of the country. Our Africa editor is Mary Harper.
When used for recreational purposes, Malawi Gold, as it's called, is considered one of the finest forms of the drug. But the authorities have stopped short of legalising it for personal use. It'll be used to make medicines and hemp fibres, which are used to make clothes, biofuel, paper and other products. Cannabis sales could supplement the tobacco trade, upon which Malawi is highly dependent. Other Southern African countries, including Zambia, Lesotho and Zimbabwe, have relaxed rules on growing the plant. But South Africa is the only one to decriminalise it for personal use.
Mary Harper reporting. Next to the Spanish opera. One of the world's most recognisable voices, the tenor Placido Domingo, seemingly rowing back on an apology he made just 2 days ago over sexual harassment allegations. At least 20 women have accused the singer of forcibly kissing, grabbing or fondling them in incidents going back to the 1980s. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd gave me the details.
Domingo had to give up his role at the Los Angeles Opera, where he was general manager, because of these allegations. On Monday of this week, he issued a very clear statement, I think, to the LA Times, in which he apologised for his previous behaviour. One quick line: I respect that these women finally felt comfortable enough to speak out. I want them to know that I am truly sorry for the hurt that I caused them. OK, that seems clear enough, but that somewhat delayed apology created a backlash. He soon had to withdraw from the Zarzuela operetta, if you like, Luisa Fernanda in Madrid, where he was due to sing in May. In reality, Spain's cultural ministry cancelled those appearances in solidarity with the affected women. My guess is he wasn't expecting this response, so now Domingo has, as you say, rowed back somewhat at least on his statement. He wanted to correct the false impression the statement had created, although of course it was his statement. Another very brief quote: I have never behaved aggressively toward anybody, nor have I ever done anything to obstruct or hurt the career of anybody. So you might say, where does that leave Monday's original statement?
This all flies in the face of the Me Too movement, the sort of mood of the times, all of that. Where does it leave him?
Well, in Spain, he's in big trouble. And of course, that's his own nation. We already knew that he won't be in Luisa Fernanda in May, but now Madrid's Teatro Real. Now, that's the big venue in Madrid, has confirmed he won't be in Verdi's La Traviata. The Teatro Real reaffirms its policy of zero tolerance towards harassment and abuse of any nature. And the Ubeda Festival in southern Spain, for instance, has cancelled his appearance at the beginning of May. It might suggest that he may not sing, on stage at least, in his own country again.
And what about other venues where he's booked? Because clearly he'll be a popular performer outside Spain. No, are other people cancelling him?
Lots of people want to see him and still want to see him. That's the complicated issue. He's still due to sing currently in Verdi's Don Carlos in July here in London at the Royal Opera House. He also has two performances scheduled at Salzburg in August.
Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd. And still to come, why China is offering to help Pakistan fight the locust epidemic with ducks. The UN Human Rights Council chief Michelle Bachelet has expressed concern over reports of police inaction during recent attacks on Muslims in the Indian capital, Delhi. Speaking at a UN conference in Geneva, Ms. Bachelet appealed to all Indian political leaders to prevent the violence in which at least 38 people have been killed.
I'm concerned by reports of police inaction in the face of attacks against Muslim by other group, as well as previous reports of excessive use of force by police against peaceful protesters. This has now widened into broader intercommunal attacks, with 34 people killed since Sunday, 23rd of February, and I appeal to all political leaders to prevent violence.
The United States has also called on all sides in India to refrain from violence. In Delhi, funerals have been taking place for some of those who've been killed. Our correspondent there is Rajini Vaidyanathan.
In the centre of a small room, a body lies wrapped in a white cloth as mourners crowd around it. They're performing the last rites for Ishtiaq, a 27-year-old Muslim man who was killed in this week's riots. Arif said his friend was shot in broad daylight as he went to buy food for his children.
We don't know where the bullet hit him. There was a lot of firing. The police were not helping us. They were with the mob.
Muhammad's still waiting to bury his 85-year-old mother, Akbari. She was suffocated by smoke after a mob set her home on fire.
They have burnt the entire house. I have got nothing left. I don't know what to do anymore.
The death toll is rising after riots flared between Hindus and Muslims. They began as protests over the government's Citizenship Act escalated earlier this week. Critics say the law discriminates against Muslims. As police continue to line the streets, there's an uneasy calm across India's capital. The mood remains tense as the fear of further violence lingers.
Rajini Vaidyanathan in Delhi. It's been revealed that the tech giant Apple doesn't allow its products to be used by villains on screen. Yep, their stuff just for the good guys. This industry secret was revealed by the film director Ryan Johnson in an interview with Vanity Fair magazine. I found out more from our reporter Ellie Costello.
Ryan Johnson, who's directed huge films, the likes of Star Wars, The Last Jedi, Looper and Knives Out, was doing a video interview and he was talking about Knives Out in particular. That's the murder mystery film which stars Daniel Craig and Jamie Lee Curtis.
I'm Detective Lieutenant Elliot and this is Trooper Wagner.
We just want to ask a few questions.
We understand the night of his demise, the family have gathered to celebrate your father's 85th birthday. How was it, by the way?
The party? Pre my dad's death? Oh, it was great.
So director Ryan Johnson was taking the viewers through a scene in that film where Jamie Lee Curtis's character, who you heard from there, is seen holding an iPhone. And that's when Ryan explained that she possibly couldn't have killed her father because the bad guy can't use iPhones in films.
The trouble is, now you've told us this, Ellie, it ruins every murder mystery, because if they've got an Apple product, they can't be the bad guy.
Yeah, it seems that way. Even Ryan joked that by revealing this information, he could potentially spoil future mystery movies by revealing who the goodies and the baddies are, even when it's supposed to be a surprise. And it's a particularly important detail in a film like Knives Out, where at one point, basically every character is suspected of murdering a wealthy crime novelist. So now we know if we see an actor with an iPhone or a MacBook, they can't possibly be guilty. And now this information, like you say, is public knowledge. Maybe filmmakers will have to be more careful about the props that their characters are using.
Talk us through from Apple's point of view. They're being very, very careful about product placement and the scenes, the images in which their products are portrayed. Why?
Well, Apple has long cultivated this immaculate brand image, and they strictly control how its products are used on the small and the big screen. And Apple products are everywhere. In 2018, the brand tracker Concave named it the top-ranking brand in films. They said, Apple products appear in one form or another in most TV shows that take place in the modern world. So perhaps it's not surprising that they do want some control over how their products are used.
And just finally, has this kind of thing ever happened before?
Yeah, this is nothing new. Back in 2008 and the making of the smash hit film Slumdog Millionaire, that's the rags to riches story set in India, brands like Coca-Cola and Mercedes didn't want to be associated with the slums. Director Danny Boyle later said in an interview that after shooting, they actually had to paint out the Coca-Cola labels because they were being drank by members of a criminal gang. So product placement can be problematic for brands, but can also have huge success stories. The best examples, well, one has got to be James Bond and his partnerships, whether it's Aston Martin, Tom Ford, Heineken. That has got to be the pinnacle of product placement.
Ellie Costello with me. In Paris, sitting outside at a cafe with a coffee, watching the world go by, is part of the way of life. But in winter, that means sitting beneath electric or gas heaters, which campaigners say are an environmental disgrace. Now, with mayoral elections approaching, there are growing calls for a ban on heated terraces. Hugh Schofield reports from the French capital.
It's reckoned that there are some 12,500 heated terraces in Paris today. Places where even on a winter's day you can sit outside and enjoy a coffee or a cigarette without feeling the cold. You just put yourself underneath one of these red glowing radiators and it's all very snug. However, it's also calculated that heating an average terrace over one winter uses the same energy as driving a car three times around the world. And that, for environmentalists like the Green Party mayor of the second arrondissement, Jacques Puteau, is an outrage.
Here in this city, we heat outside in winter because you need more comfort. It's totally absurd. It's a folly of rich men. We have to stop that because there is an urgency for the climate.
It may feel like they've been there forever, but in fact, heated terraces have only been around for the last 10 or 12 years, basically since a ban came into effect on smoking inside bars and cafes. Today, the outside heaters are enjoyed by smokers and non-smokers alike, but most people seem to accept the idea that their days may be numbered.
Surely, selfishly, it would be a pain if they took away the heated terraces. It's nice to smoke outside and stay warm, but of course we also have to think about what it means for the environment.
I think they are going to be banned. They are in contradiction with everything we are doing to fight climate change. It's just idiotic. We are heating up the outside.
One city in France, Rennes, has now banned heated terraces, and the cause is gaining momentum ahead of next month's town hall elections. But the decision is not straightforward. Smokers are asking where else they can go for a cigarette, and cafe owners are very worried about the impact on them. Marcel Benazet speaks for one of the main cafe owners' associations.
If tomorrow they said we can no longer heat our terraces, we wouldn't need nearly so many staff in the winter month. We'd become part-time employers, seasonal employers. It would not be good for jobs.
Sitting outside, snug in winter, is a very pleasant thing to do. But if fighting climate change means making adjustments to our way of life, this looks like one luxury that we may well soon have to forego.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. With swarms of locusts devastating crops in East Africa and South Asia, The government of Pakistan has declared a state of emergency to deal with the infestation. Now its neighbour China has proposed an unusual form of aid, 100,000 ducks, mallard ducks, which Beijing hopes can keep the locust population in check. I asked our China media analyst Kerry Allen why China considers ducks to be its secret weapon.
They can eat a lot and they can eat fast. So this is something that specialists in China have said that has been practiced since ancient times. And they've managed to work out that on average, a mallard duck can eat 200 locusts, as opposed to, say, chickens, which can only eat 80 in a day. So ducks like a locust.
So the idea that ducks keep locusts at bay is not new. And now it's being brought into Pakistan.
Yes, well, there is the hope is going to happen. So in east of China, an area called Ningbo, it's quite common for ducks to be bred. So there are a large number of ducks that can be sent over. And also, we have to remember that this is a form of diplomacy. Even though at the moment, all we've been hearing about has been the coronavirus and China getting sick, this has been a major issue affecting Pakistan, declaring it an emergency early this month, at worst in two decades. So China has seen an opportunity to be able to provide some aid to Pakistan, animal diplomacy.
And there will be people listening who are thinking, hang on a minute, if you take a load of ducks out of China, maybe they could spread the coronavirus. What are the scientists saying about the possibility of that?
Well, this has been one of the big discussions on social media because with people unable to travel in China, there is actually a lot of concern for these ducks. So people have been saying, we don't know what animal has caused this yet. There have been conspiracy theories about whether it's been bats, whether it's been other wild animals, and we don't know that animals can get the virus. So there are concerns both for these animals, but also whether they might be carriers. But there are questions being asked at the moment about whether they are going to be sent, because there have been specialists who've raised questions about whether these ducks will be able to survive in Pakistan, because they're going to be sent to very dry conditions and ducks need a lot of water. So for the time being, an official at China's Locust Disaster Control Working Group has said that these ducks haven't yet entered the government assistance programme, so there may be some red tape in sending them. But universities in Pakistan and China are speaking to each other about this happening.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. And if you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, do drop us an email. We love hearing from you. And the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.